Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Live to another edition of Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. My name is Bob Carson. Pleased to be with you this Sunday, March 15th. Hopefully I'm coming in loud and clear. It wouldn't be a day in the life of Bob Carson if I didn't have any type of a problem, some sort of issue, or some sort of a technical issue. My car broke down a few days ago, and I'm without a car, and I had to start this new class, this new accounting class, or it deals with statistical analysis, and it's just really, really time-consuming. So I must confess, I haven't had an opportunity to really look at what's going on in the world. I've been really, really besieged over the past week or so, and so You know, for that, we're going to turn to Christopher Allen Driscoll of the Election Boycott Advocates. But before we do, I want to remind you to give us a call at 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. We are without Thomas this evening. We are, however, with Christopher Allen Driscoll and, of course, Bob Carson, both members of the Election Boycott Advocates. Christopher, welcome back to Carson's Corner.
Hi, Bob. You're coming
How are
in
you,
loud and clear. I'm doing pretty good. I'm really happy to hear your voice coming in crystal clear. None of the technical difficulties that you've had in recent times. But
yeah,
this has been kind of a difficult week for you. I know that. But you got through it. And you're still standing.
Yep.
You're not too far from Philly, so you could actually go and do one of those runs up the stairs of, like Stallone did, and jump and shout and say, "I'm still standing. Bob Carson
you know,
is still here and still on Carson's Corner."
Chris, you know what's amazing about that character, Rocky, and let's be honest, this is a very, very inspirational character. I mean, you know, there really is almost a Rocky in every single one of us, but I look at it in terms of a political context. I think that Sylvester Stallone and that character has done more in this country to advance myths out there that ultimately proved to be destructive, I think, to the working class. I mean, you know, people just do not realize just how convincing that story is, the Rocky story and the character. And Sylvester Stallone, you know, he's almost been like a right-wing cult figure in Hollywood. I mean, you look at the movies that he's doing, like, for example, there's one of his series, I think it's The Expendables, and he's cultivating these younger movie stars who undoubtedly have the same worldview as he does. You know, he's cultivating the next generation of Sylvester Stallones to really be seen in Hollywood. And you know, that's one of the many things I think that we're up against. It's kind of cynical of me to look at it like that, but I do look at Rocky and I do look at all of those films and Sylvester Stallone in a political context.
Well, and so many, I mean, not every film is political, but so many are. And, you know, Rocky, those Rocky movies, they came along at a time when almost every sport was become dominated by black people,
right.
and brown people as well. And I think it was kind of like a pathetic, a wish fulfillment, wishful thinking thing that, at least in the movies we can have our great white hope. I know that you are one of those people who are into boxing.
Right.
I enjoy the occasional boxing match too, but I've never really been, you know, like a boxing aficionado. But you look at from the political perspective at that time. I mean, look at the great boxers that we had, who most of whom took very progressive, pro-worker positions. I mean, none better than Muhammad Ali, who stood up for the entire working class, stood up for black workers, who stood up for people, you know, I mean, who even risked going to jail to stand up against the Vietnam War, the horrors of the Vietnam War. You know, he was just such a champion, not only in the world of sports, but he was a champion for real for us common folk.
Right.
I always felt, and so of course the right wing, the right wing always uses racism to try to divide the working class. It's been one of their most effective tricks. And they're still doing it today, you know.
Yeah.
But, That's exactly. I mean, you are exactly. You're exactly right. That's what Rocky was all about, and it was a great movie. But you know, I mean, I think you always have to separate looking at a work of art as a work of art and as a work of propaganda, and you always have to be aware. I mean, you always should be aware. I believe that that a great work of art can also be used to advance a kind of a terrible, you know, position.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Gone with the Wind, one of the greatest movies ever made, but it advanced an extremely reactionary, almost fascistic message. So.
Yeah, and that it serves its purpose, and that's what I think that the Rocky movies, the type of ideology. I mean, you can even look at the later Rockies in 1984, Rocky IV, 1984, 1983 came out, and that was at a time, of course, you know, during the so-called Cold War, and there's just many stereotypes played in that film, just like there was in Rocky I with the quintessential black boxer. In Apollo Creed, you know, he was flashy, he was cocky, the way African Americans are often portrayed, and it's difficult to get over because the capitalists really use that argument. They really use the anecdotes out there, the Rocky story, the exceptions to the rule, to basically, you know, serve as a propaganda tool. And I'm telling you that mindset, you know, exists. Really, throughout this country, that this believe it and achieve it, and I don't want to say that people aren't natural like that. I mean, believe me, you know, we all have aspirations. I mean, it's not like we're sitting here. We want to be sitting in a apartment and you know, living in you know, squalor or anything like that. We all have dreams. That's inherent upon everyone, but it's this. They take that out there. They use that to sort of justify these conditions and justify any type of income inequality and justify hardship by saying that, oh, you could do it, you can get out of it. They use the anecdote to basically, you know, neutralize the population. And, you know, you mentioned boxing. It's interesting because during the, I think when Reagan came out, we all have studied Ronald Reagan and his impact on race relations and how he won the presidency and all of his anti-welfare recipient speeches and just, you know, I could spend an entire show on that. But one of the things that caused controversy was Jerry Cooney, who was a white boxer. I think not too far from this area. I think he grew up in New York or maybe even New Jersey. He's a very nice guy, Jerry Cooney. And they call him the gentleman, Jerry Cooney. And he was fighting Muhammad Ali. And Reagan actually had a phone installed in Jerry Cooney's dressing room so that he could call Jerry Cooney when he beat Muhammad Ali. Of course, he didn't beat Muhammad Ali. And many people saw him as you know, essentially rooting against the black guy, the outspoken black guy in Muhammad Ali, you know, who was very, very friendly with Malcolm X and whatnot. And it just goes to show you that, yeah, these issues, you know, probably more so than any other sport, extend to boxing, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Boxing movies have always been big at the box office. People like to go see them. So it's, you know, it's a way for the billionaire class to get its stranglehold over our minds and do it in a subtle way. Yeah.
Yeah. As sports in general, I think that's a big, big thing is, you know, I like certain sports like mixed martial arts. I used to do that years ago. And I cover it from a basic class perspective and whatnot. But I want to, we got a lot to talk about here. You know, as I said at the top of the show, I've been just besieged with a lot of different things, work. My car broke down. I'm currently without a car. I've been without a car for like 3 days, and I got this new class. So I've been a little bit behind, but there's been a lot of developments, Christopher. I know that you are an avid follower of the news. You're reading a bunch of different papers and blog posts. So is there anything that you want to start out with here?
Well, I mean, there's so much. For a week, and you know, to, if we wanted to go on with the topic of race relations and racism in the United States, we had the fraternity in Oklahoma at the University of Oklahoma, where they were singing an incredibly racist song that championed lynching black people, and it's just a horrid. I watched the video of it. It's just a horrid thing to think that young people, young white college students in this day and age would be singing something like that on an official school trip. I think it shocked people. The fraternity involved has been shut down by the university. Right. It's been basically asked to exit the university grounds.
Since
we last met, there's been I think Friday before, there was the killing of a person in Wisconsin.
Right.
A young black man by police. There was the shooting of two police officers in Ferguson during a late night demonstration in front of the police headquarters, which I just read that they've arrested a suspect in that, who was a young black man who was apparently at the at least according to the report I read, it was at the demonstration, then left and came back, and they don't really know any of the reason behind why he did what he did, or if he was even actually targeting the police. There's some suspicion that he might have been targeting someone in the crowd. This stuff just doesn't let up.
Yeah.
I think the Daily Cause this morning had a list of something like, 31 young black men who've been shot by the police since the beginning of the year, comparing that to the two police officers that were shot in Ferguson. This is incredibly troubling, and of course, last week was the 50th anniversary of the Selma March, President Barack Obama gave a speech during the commemoration of the Selma March, which I think was kind of disappointing to a lot of people, because he didn't really talk about the real issues he didn't speak too much about the real issues that black people are confronting today. The fact that under the first black president, black people are economically worse off today than they were 50 years ago. Having a half white, half black person who grew up in a white family in privileged circumstances in Hawaii, went to the most prestigious high school on the island, private high school, and then went on to very expensive higher education. That putting that person in the White House has not really helped African Americans at all in any way, shape, or form, except for, the very kind of like symbolic level of having broken one barrier. But, you know, it just goes to show when you have black leaders who represent the billionaire class and who sell their souls to the billionaire class, as Obama did long, long ago, getting that kind of person into positions of power, as we've seen in, you know, cities all across the country where black mayors have been elected, that doesn't really help.
It doesn't. And the problems that we talk about here, you know, you went through a litany of different things, starting with the racist chant in Oklahoma at the University of Oklahoma, which I thought the university seemingly handled that pretty well. They had a decent response, but what that plus the continued shootings of African Americans that we've seen, all of these different these issues, and the individual that was arrested for shooting the Ferguson police officers, there was some discrepancy as to whether or not he was at the protest. There was several reports that said he was. However, some of the protesters said that they don't remember seeing him. That will be determined, and we condemn, you know, all violence you know, directed at anybody. But what we should underscore here, I think, is that this type of racism, unfortunately, is pervasive among the white community. I mean, there is just absolutely no question about that. I attended a Workers' World Party march in October with my good friend Brad Hullhut, who hosts Pink of the Bear Radio. One of the chants that they came up with, the folks over at the WWP, was, you know, racism is the boss's tool. You can look at struggles, look at the various different worker struggles in America. Cesar Chavez, for example, when he was organizing in California, the migrant workers, he constantly had to deal with the racial attacks and whatnot directed at him and directed at his family, his workers. You know, these derogatory terms used to downgrade minorities that are continually used today in the public discourse. All of this, you know, ultimately serves a purpose to divide the classes, and so that capitalism can continue to grow at all of our expense. But we have to point out that this is white America, and also what happened last week. Another reported thing, reported news item that I think relates to what we're talking about here, is that Fox News has suddenly become the most trusted news network in America. Now, according, I think, to a Quinnipiac poll, I mean, it could be a snapshot, but even if it's not a snapshot, it's certainly the most watched news network, not a news, but a cable network out of all three, and there are different reasons for that. But what that tells me, and you know, you could look at the talk radio and whatnot, that we have a lot of racially aggrieved white Americans out there. 98% of Fox News' primetime audience is white. The Republican Party gets 90% of its support from white America. 98% is white. We have a lot of pissed off white people out there that are getting more and more and more pissed off and angry, listening to media outlets designed to keep them in a constant state of agitation, to blame the minority, to blame the welfare recipient, to blame the immigrant, blame whoever the bosses throw in front of them, to alleviate the responsibility on the part of the real culprits, which have always been the billionaire class. And we have to acknowledge that, hey, listen, you know, we have real racial divide that we've spoken about on this program many times, and this is not going away anytime soon. It's really up to us to try to change the consciousness out there, because you've said on the show, Christopher, either we're going to sink on the same ship, you know, fighting each other, or we're going to try to remain. We're going to work together and try to remain afloat as we're besieged by the material conditions of capitalism. That's either we're going to sink or we're going to float, or we're going to, you know. And I think that we're at that point now, because you know you mentioned that these problems are not going away. They're going
Absolutely.
To continue to plague us until you know something gives. And what I try to do is I try to not focus on single issues. Yes, we have a problem with police brutality. Yes, we have a problem, you know, with various forms of oppression. But these forms of oppression are tied to capitalism, and I don't see the point. And maybe you disagree with me in focusing on single issues. It's like focusing on the symptoms of cancer. You know, cancer. A cancer patient will throw up. A cancer patient will lose their hair. A cancer patient
yeah.
will experience
yeah.
any number of these physical ailments. And if you treat the individual symptoms, you're still going to have the disease and you're still going to die. You have to treat the cancer itself. And in my opinion, the cancer right now is capitalism, and that's what we have to really organize around.
Yes. I agree with you 100%. You know, America, it brings to mind something about of a peculiarity, a uniqueness about the United States of America, and that is the United States of America is the only advanced industrialized country in the world that does not have a labor worker oriented political party. And the what you're talking about, focusing on the big picture, focusing on the economic and cultural systems that oppress us, and focusing on capitalism, the one word that talks about it, the one word that describes all that.
Right.
You know, in countries where you have a workers' party, that's one of the major parties, there's a natural focus towards that, and
right.
and you know, people talk about it more. Whereas in the United States, where we do not have a workers' party, where we don't
right.
have one central political group that brings people from the whole wide working class together, one of the side effects of that, some of the fallout of that, is that single issue politics becomes much more it's like the default choice, because you don't have this thing bringing everybody together for a single focus. So people who are black and suffering from the oppression that black people have are going to focus on that single issue naturally. People who you know, oppose a war are going to focus on building an anti-war movement. And among the activist left, you know, we tend to be kind of like grasshoppers, hopping from one single issue to the next, hopping on the bandwagon of whichever
right.
big single issue, you know, is big at the time. I mean, when I look back on my career, I guess you could call it semi-career, you know, as a left activist in the United States, it's just mind-boggling how many different single issues I've jumped from one to the next to the next. As
right.
one came up, another went down, you know, the anti-war movement in Vietnam, and then the anti-draft movement in the early 80s, and then the, you know, the solidarity movement with the people of Central America who were, you know, under the gun at that time in civil wars that the United States was instigating against them. You know, the list can just go on and on and on. You know, we had the Occupy movement, and before that,
right.
in the early part of the 2000s, we had the Global Justice movement. And, you know, it's kind of a natural fallout. And we really do. I agree with you. And that's why, you know, I think that our movement supporting the non-voter and supporting the whole idea of of noncompliance with voting and noncompliance with elections and noncompliance, mm-hmm. spreading our noncompliance out from that, I think is a good idea because it's a way for us to start grappling with the real central problem, which is what?
Yeah. that's a very good point. That is exactly how I look at it. That is exactly how I view it. And, you know, we talked about this before on this program. You mentioned this, how, you know, the Libertarian Party, which is the largest third party in the United States, the Communist Workers Party, which I believe is the largest political party in the world, in China. These parties, these movements, if you want to call them that, they started out pretty slow, pretty small.
Yeah, yeah,
and they eventually
yeah.
built to a point. And look, let me tell you something. I, regardless of the issue, the single issue that's being talked about in the corporate media or what seems to galvanize, you know, both sides of the political coin, if you will, I am absolutely sturdy, absolutely certain in my belief in boycotting the elections and the importance of boycotting the elections and non-compliance leading to radical revolutionary change. And that's something that's, you know, that's going to exist. I don't give up on things. I mean, I've been doing my podcast for, you know, this podcast, Carson's Corner, the political show, since 2008. And, you know, I started out supporting President Obama. I was on college radio. Needless to say, you know, a lot of college students didn't like my point of view. I was a little bit older than your typical students at Rider University, but they, you know, respected me in the sense that I got out there behind a microphone and spoke my ideas and didn't leave nothing behind. And now, you know, I started to drift, and now I'm starting to see just how meaningless elections are. And now I'm a full-fledged election boycott advocate, and that is the most important thing that I think that I could be doing, is advocating boycotting the elections as a way to change things from what they are. Because, again, you know, Thomas keeps on saying this over and over again, is that, you know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Well, you know, the working class in America are suffering. It's only going to continue to get worse. And these aren't, you know, negative attitudes. These aren't us being pessimistic. These are the laws of capitalism. And that's what I'm starting to focus on, because, you know, Fred Goldstein points this out, is that there's a natural attraction between workers and socialism. People want the wealth produced to be shared on a wide scale, not just going to the few exploiters in our economy. And, you know, we understand that the ditching of the profit system, having a system in which your reward is leisure, your reward is, you know, being able to have your needs addressed, and therefore you could become more creative. You could spend more time with your family. You can actually live a better, more productive life by many accounts if we get rid of the profit motive, which warps every aspect of our society. And so, you know, I've really kind of, my consciousness has really gone to a new level, and it's been through experience. It's been through, you know, we were talking early about Rocky, and it all relates back to this ideology, whereas if you're poor in America, you know, you're told to blame yourself. Blame, you have nobody to blame but yourself. You know, your life is a product of choices, right? It all comes down to individual choices, and the rich guy is richer because he made better choices than you did, and he deserves his opulence and all of that. And it, you know, it's just absolute nonsense, because if you look at the system, you look at the economic system, you study the trends, you study the laws of capitalism, it has nothing to do. Your choices are limited by things that are way, way, way beyond your control. And I just don't think that people have that much control over their lives in the capitalist system. I mean, the family you're born into, the economic system, all of these different things play a role to the point where they say that the number one determining factor of where someone will be when they enter adulthood is where their parents were. And that is, I don't see how anybody can look at the data and see otherwise. And so, this is what we have to, I think one of the things we have to drive home to people is that the working class is in the position they're in right now. And, you know, you mentioned strata, and I'm at the strata where, you know, I'm above a someone in poverty, but I'm probably in the lower to middle spectrum of working class person in America, despite my education, which is surprisingly high given what I make at my job. But we're not in the position because of anything we've done. There's a growing number of people that are experiencing a downgrade in the capitalist system, and it's not because of individual choices as is depicted in the corporate media. And so what emerges out of this is a systematic analysis of why people are in the position that they're in.
Yeah, there are many, many people who are in the same position that you're in, Bob, where they work so hard at getting a good education. You know, you're probably one of the most well-educated people around.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, if the opportunities are contracting, and we know that they are, you know, they tout they shout from the highest hills over the last couple of weeks about the low, so-called low unemployment rate, and yet, as we've discussed on this show in the past, there are less people working today than at any other time for decades. Why is that? It's because so many people have been pushed out of the job market, are no longer working, have given up. You know, I saw another article yesterday, only 23% of the officially unemployed get unemployment insurance. That's the lowest level in decades.
Wow.
You know, what does that mean? It means even among the incredibly low figure, you know, that they've cooked the books on of official unemployed, you know, more than 75% have exhausted all their unemployment compensation.
Wow.
You know, and I mean, we should point out to people, the United States of America is peculiar. It's unique, and it's not unique in a good way. Every other advanced industrial country, you wouldn't have people, you know, after 24 weeks of unemployment, getting no more unemployment insurance.
Yep.
You know, in Britain, as long as you're unemployed, you get unemployment insurance.
Yep.
If you were unemployed for the next 50 years, you'd get unemployment insurance for the next 50 years. In Germany, it's 5 years. You get 5 years of unemployment automatically. Okay, so this is, you know, Americans really need to wake up and smell the coffee and really need to realize that even among capitalist countries, the working class in the United States is treated like garbage.
Oh, yeah.
You know? In so many ways. I mean, I was thinking of this earlier. Of we were having a laugh about the you know, the Pi Day, 3.14 Day. Did you hear about that? Maybe you didn't hear about it but yesterday was supposedly Pi Day. I think it had something to do with the date. And I said, well, you know, we need to start demanding a Pi Day holiday, you know, because we're way behind. The average American gets 11 holidays, paid holidays a year. The average European gets 28 paid holidays a year. That's not even talking about the difference in vacation that we get, you know.
Yeah.
My friend said, well, I hate to burst your bubble, but the next Pi Day is like 107 years from now.
Uh-oh.
I said, well, forget it. Forget that holiday.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, we can go across every social benefit that working people in most advanced countries enjoy. And in the United States, we either don't enjoy it at all or we enjoy it much less.
Well, you know, and this has all happened, too. A lot of these inadequacies in terms of people receiving government assistance and not getting them can be traced right back to the Clinton administration. I mean, the Republican Party is a natural adversary to the poor. They're proud of it. They can, you know, Mitt Romney can talk about 47% of Americans can't take personal responsibility. They consider themselves victims. And that message resonates with so many white Americans who think that voting against a candidate who's anti-government is voting against minorities. And you could trace it right back to that. But Bill Clinton, you know, in the 1990s, declaring the era of big government as being over, and is teaming up with Newt Gingrich and others to, quote, reform the welfare program, as if it's welfare that is somehow ailing our economy, as if that's ever been the case, has put so many poor Americans to the point where you've got two-thirds of poor Americans that can't even get government assistance because that are in poverty that can't even get government assistance because of the reforms. And I was just talking to my sister before we went on air. My sister had to pick me up because I don't have a car. And she's like, you know, Bob, why don't you qualify for government assistance? Why don't you see, you know, because I'm living with her at the time. I laughed at her. I said, are you kidding me? I said, I make way too much money to qualify for any type of government assistance, because according to you know, the government, I'm living high on the hog based on what I'm making. I don't want to tell, but basically, that's it. So a guy like myself, I can't even, and even if I do qualify for government assistance, it's so meager. It's not even anything. It's really, really nothing that is any type of protection in our society. And so what you have now is a reserved army of labor, as Karl Marx talked about, that is available for use by the capitalists any time. It's all about driving down wages. What little comfort that the working class has in terms of these programs that we talk about are under attack, under continued attack, and will be, because the capitalists want to ensure their cut of the budget each year to compensate for the declining rate of profit. We talked about education. Technological advancement has decreased the need for high educated employees. I mean, there's no question about that. All of us, think about all of us. We have more skills than our jobs require, because the goal of capitalism is to reduce skill and increase the efficiency of labor through machinery. And so this is what we're competing against, and this is what is making life a living hell for just about everybody in the working class. And yeah, we have to wake up Americans to make them understand that no, we have nothing compared to other countries. I mean, you mentioned some of the countries in Europe. You mentioned Britain, and they have much higher, much more general programs. In many of these countries, they may have a slightly higher unemployment rate, pay a slightly higher tax rate, but the only reason why they have a higher unemployment rate is because people can get unemployment for the right job, because they're not going to be off of unemployment they are here in the United States. So that they don't have the problem that we have here in America.
Plus, in those countries, they're actually counting the unemployed. You know, there's a big difference there. I've looked at this, and I'm not too convinced that Europe really does have a higher unemployment rate. I think what Europe has is a higher rate of counting the unemployed. You know, as I said, like in Britain, you stay on unemployment insurance for as long as you're unemployed, so you're counted as long as you're unemployed. That doesn't happen in the United States. you know.
Because of the employment situation, and employment is almost obsolete now, as we're talking about, you know, the more production from fewer workers. We've seen the jobless recoveries that we've seen, and the problem for individuals, so many people like myself, to the emergency room. I went to the emergency room 1 week ago. Okay, $5,000 it costs. Right now, my health insurance, like many workers in America, is tied to my employment, which makes me more and more dependent upon my employers. If I had children, it'd be even worse. But so now my
That's why they're opposed to social health insurance.
Of course,
because it would untie you from their employment.
Yeah, that's just one of the reasons, and another reason I think Noam Chomsky talks about it, that it's predicated on a very dangerous idea that if you take the profit motive out of the healthcare system and you have a system which can invite the caring of other people might get together and undermine authority, and all that's why, you know, these things are always under attack. I mean, public teachers, anything to do with altruism in our society, because we all have to be individual. We're just a collection of individuals trying to get up the income ladder. That's we've been reduced to. But it's absolutely devastating. It really is, and you know. So I'm stuck with this huge bill now, and it's just, if I had been admitted into the hospital, been worse, and you know, it's just around we go in this bill until we can say, you know what, it's the elections that's the catalyst for this. It's the election system, these farcical phony elections that the billionaires spend billions of dollars trying to convince us are so important, yet such small percentage of the population actually votes. That is the driving force behind all of this, because you legitimize everything. You legitimize our healthcare system. You legitimize our tax system. You legitimize our defense system. Everything, our whole economic system, once you step foot in the voting box, the voting booth. And that's something we have to discourage. And again, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I'm completely resolved in my support for the election boycott advocates. And I think a lot of people, as we continue this road, are going to come to the realization that, you know, as you said, Christopher, the working class has no power in the voting booth.
Absolutely. You know, there's a famous intellectual leader of the Italian Communist Party in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. His name was Antonio Gramsci. And Gramsci spent a lot of time in jail, years and years, during the reign of Mussolini. You know, Mussolini basically ran most communists and socialists out of the country or put them in jail. Mussolini, who himself had been a leader of the Socialist Party prior to World War One, prior to when he invented fascism, ended up jailing a lot of his former comrades and friends. Anyway, Gramsci had a theory. It's basically along the lines of that part of the way the capitalist class rules and is able to rule when it's so obvious that they're not ruling in our interests is through a hegemony over culture. And the aim of that hegemony over culture, of course, hegemony means just like a totalitarian iron grip over the culture, over what people hear, what people are educated with, what people see on the back then it was the movies, you know, and the radio, and the newspapers, and a part of that, a main aim of that hegemony over culture is convincing people that the total structure of the government that they have, of the state that they have, is something that's in their interests, and it's something that they owe allegiance to. It's, you know, the fascists spent a lot of time drilling it into people in Italy, this idea that part of patriotism, in other words, part of love of country, was to love your government and to love your state and
right.
to submit yourself and all of you to the state and to, you know, what... anyway, it's always been my opinion, especially since we started election boycott advocates, that an essential component in breaking that hegemony over culture in the United States, an area where we can break that hegemony, break it in half and toss it to the ground, is in voting. Because voting is an essential ingredient in this masquerade that they put on, in this farce. Voting, the idea that somehow we are choosing our own rulers, even though all the evidence shows that our rulers come from the billionaire class, and
right.
It's their billions that give them the ability to control everything, and that the billionaires use their enormous amounts of money to buy politicians. The way Hightower used to say in that book he had, the best government money can buy. You know, we all know this. This is not a surprise to Americans. We know somewhere deep down our government is bought by the billionaires. It's not voted on. It's not voted into power by us. You know, so if we can break that key component of this whole hegemony over our culture, you know, that's the first step, in my opinion, towards really getting rid of this billionaire ruling class that is oppressing us and that is putting us into this onerous situation that so many of us are in. And even those who are not in the worst of situations, where just weeks from the streets, you know, we're living paycheck to paycheck, let's face it. So there, but for the grace of God, go you.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take long to break a family in America today. Even, you know, a pretty well-to-do a working class or lower middle class family, they're living weeks from the street, paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah,
and
I like
all it takes is like, I used that in my gubernatorial campaign running for governor of Maryland in 2006. Weeks from the street, you know, paycheck to paycheck. Most people in the United States are, and all it takes is a $5,000 emergency bill. Hospital bill to break you a lot of times for a lot of people.
And you mentioned the hegemony. You mentioned the work of Antonio Gramsci. You know, it's so clear to me and to you know, people like you as well, is that our interests account for nothing in the media. Our interests literally account for nothing. You can get no coverage virtually of issues that face the working class and the corporate media. Everything is, as Peter Joseph says, is economic abstractions, the rate of inflation, the unemployment rate, the GDP, the rate of growth, what percentage of stocks and bonds, and all of these abstract concepts have no meaning whatsoever to people. The working class of America. It's not even talking of go compare your newspaper's labor section to the business section. As Noam Chomsky says, there is no labor section. Lately, personally reported.
There used to be in the old days.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There used to be in the old days. They always had labor reporters and, you know, but nah, no more. You know,
when they
had
less of a control over the culture. Now, it's virtually non-existent as the media has consolidated to further protect the corporate interest, to further just control our culture. We've spoken a lot about the media now. They own everything. They own the culture. This is exactly, I think, what Gramsci is talking about. And it's to me, you know, our solution is to establish our own institutions, establish what we're doing, and forget about this corporate-owned, corporate-driven media out there that serves to basically gain compliance of the population, which they have done, I mean, so effectively. You know, it's ridiculous. It's almost depressing just how strong of a hold they have over everything. I mean, you can. I'm at the point now. You know, I always love going to some of these political conventions. I may go to the left forum. I don't know. It depends. I'm not really too active of a person when it comes to, you know, interacting in person with people. But I love going to these events because you could tell you're with your class by the way people dress, by, you know, the way they look. I think a lot of times you could tell. Hey, listen, I'm in a room full of workers. Room full of people that understand that, you know, appearance and looks and whatnot are really just, you know, superficial measures. It's really almost, I look at even dressing up as a form of compliance. I mean, you know, you have to look your best. You have to look this way. You have to look that way. You have to look like what you see on the corporate media, or else you're not going to get accepted. You're not going to, girls not going to talk to you. You're not going to, you're just going to be a loser. You're going to be a schlub. Well, you know, I think, you know, I like to be around people that get it. You know, we get it. But it's you look at the malls, you look at what's on television, you look at just a majority of Americans that unfortunately are infected by, you know, this corporate takeover. And they don't even have a clue. I mean, these people don't even have a clue about, I think, what's going on. They're happy to try to just live, you know, out of a magazine, or live, you know, like they do on television. And it's just, you know, we have so much work ahead of us. But then again, as you pointed out, you know, consciousness changes very quickly in times of revolution. And, you know, that's something at least we have. You know, today they're talking about Hillary Clinton's emails, or they're talking about this letter that the Republicans sent. You know, next year, 6 months from now, whatever, we could have a movement where they're talking about, you know, alternatives to capitalism. They're talking about, you know, things move that quickly. That's at least something we have in our favor.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, in the meantime, it's always been my opinion, you speak to your core, you speak to your, you know, you speak to the choir, basically. You know, I got to tell you, one of the stupidest things you hear in the broad left in the United States today, oh, we're just speaking to the choir. Well, you know what? That's what we need to be doing right now. We need to be energizing the choir, because we need a big, loud choir to start shouting out to the masses. The masses, part of the reason that the masses that you're talking about are, you know, taken up with all this frivolous, all this frivolity, all this meaningless, you know, what do my fingernails look like? And I mean, my granddaughter just told me how much she spent on getting her fingernails done last week, and my jaw dropped. You know, and I mean, she's just a typical example of people around the country who, you know, you gotta focus on getting the core, the base, energized enough around a specific item, and frankly, right now, the item that we would really be great if we all got jazzed about would be a new anti-capitalist movement, anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism. That's where we need to go now in our trajectory. But you know what? As we were just talking about a few minutes back, you know, the left in the United States is all over the place.
Yeah.
Think about it. You know, they're literally all over the place. We need to draw them together around a couple of action items.
Yep.
Like, you know, let's end capitalism.
Yeah, connect the oppressed, which is something that Alan Moss talks about. And the other side, they don't have this problem. I mean, you know, the Tea Party, they're anti-government, they're anti, you know, immigrant, they're anti-union, they're anti-working class, you know, anything that could be seen to benefit the minority. And, you know, what do they do? Look, I mean, they have, you know, they're nominating their people, that they've succeeded in bringing the party.
Bob, there's an example, okay? The Washington Post, ABC News, just did a poll of Tea Party supporters. They found that about 18% of Americans are Tea Party supporters, which basically, what you're really talking about is a big broad right-wing section of the Republican Party supports the Tea Party. However, what they've really found out is that your real Tea Party activists are about 2% of the population. Those are the people, you know, that's still a lot of people. I mean, 2% of America is millions of people. But that 2% are the people who are really out, you know, going to the Tea Party meetings, raising money for the Tea Party. Okay, and this is what I'm talking about, too. You know, for the left, our goal should be right now, at this time, preach to the choir.
Yeah.
That 2% that might be the choir, okay? You get them together and they are powerful.
Yeah.
And that's that's what the right wing in this country has come to realize. And it's not just over the Tea Party. The Tea Party is just a gimmick.
Yeah, right.
You know, this movement's been around for decades. It's the conservative wing of the Republican Party is what we're talking about. And the conservative wing of the Republican Party have found different gimmicks, and that's what they are, to bring their core constituencies together into powerful movements. Of course, it helps that they've got the billionaires on their side pumping money into, you know, which we don't have. But we have people power, and we've got to start learning how to use it. We've got to stop, we've got to somehow convince the broad left in the United States to stop spinning its wheels around the Democrat Party, spinning its wheels around, you know, minor issues, and come together, first of all, outside the major parties and outside the electoral arena, in a broad, powerful 2%, if we only have 2%, you know? I mean, recent polls have shown that something approaching 40% of Americans favor socialist ideas, and that more than 50% of young people under 30 support socialism. You know, certainly we could get 2% out of that.
Well,
of the population, which would be millions of people, and we need to get them together and start, you know, really, really focusing our attention and stop spinning our wheels on the shim sham of the Democrat Party. Number one, which is just a total waste of time and has been a waste of time. And I mean, I constantly urge people, think about the history. You know, go back to 1936 when the labor movement and the left first started supporting supporting the Democrat Party. It was a crucial election. FDR was running for his second term and wasn't sure that he was going to win. And he brought together this massive coalition of labor, left, and you know, other working class oppressed minorities, and he won his election. And, you know, I mean, at least since the 1960s, since the end of the 1960s, our support, our in the sense of the working class and labor and so forth, our support of the Democratic Party has resulted in the Democratic Party moving more and more and more and more to the right.
Right.
Now, everybody can see that. We can look at Barack Obama, and everybody agrees Richard Nixon 40 years ago was to the left of where Obama is today. How'd that happen?
Right.
How'd that happen, Bob? We know how it happened. We threw our votes down this sinkhole called the Democrat Party, and the Democrat Party took us for granted. They said, oh, we've got the left all locked up.
Right.
Why bother worrying about them? We'll turn to the right, you know, to try to get extra votes from the right. We'll turn to business. We'll turn to the billionaires, you know. And that's how the Democrat Party changed. We enabled, we the left in the United States, we the working class in the United States, we enabled the Democrat Party to become the right-wing, far right-wing entity that it is today. I mean, you know, people in the 1970s, if they saw what the Democrat Party is today and what it votes for in Congress today and what it stands for today, would be appalled. They'd think, that's the Democratic Party?
Right.
It can't be. Isn't the Democratic Party supposed to be for labor, for black people, for brown people, for women? And yet you look at this clown, this tyrant in the White House today, first black president, and he's to the right of Richard Nixon, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, it's such a sorry state of affairs. And, you know, if we gave him, we enabled it, we can also deactivate it. That's what I think we need to do, and that's what we're trying to do is just, you know, let's take their power away. Let's get. I try to talk to people all the time. You know, my brother is an avid a Fox News viewer. I mean, he watches Fox News primetime programming, and he is I can't even talk politics with him because I wind up getting into a fight with him. It gets that intense, and that's not even an overstatement. That's the absolute truth. So I generally try to avoid conflict with him. I generally try to just, when he tries to goad me into debates, and he tries to, you know, but he's very truncated, like many of them, in their thinking. Like he, you know, it's all about these labels that. They basically, you know, allow themselves to think in boxes using these labels. And, you know, that's one of the things that Ralph Nader talks about is escaping the labels. Let's you know, realize, let's look at the Democratic Party for what they are. The Democratic Party is a capitalist party that is no more of a friend to the working folk than their Republican counterparts. Okay, let's look at President Obama for what he is. Let's not allow them to tell you that he's somehow a liberal. He's somehow a radical. He's a Linskyite. Look at his actions. President Obama is anything, you know, what he's depicted as in the corporate media. And once you start to escape these labels, and once you start to, you know, basically have a different type of analysis on things, I think you can find yourself coming to different conclusions about, you know, the certain assumptions that are basically given to us, you know, going back to decades. I mean, even, you know, Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan was against abolishing he famously said, "I'm out to end the Great Society, not the New Deal." And, you know, he voted for FDR, he said, four times and whatnot. And, you know, Reagan was much different than the Republican Party is today. But, you know, all of these labels and our way of looking at things really have to change. And I think that our side, it all goes back to noncompliance. We cannot accept the institutions as they exist now. We cannot accept the economic system as it exists now, or any type of semblance of this economic system. We cannot accept politicians as they exist now, or perhaps in any form. We have to declare our rulers. We have to declare our ruling institutions. We have to declare, you know, everything, our founding documents, as invalid. Everything has to be considered invalid, and therefore working within an invalid system is meaningless. It's not going to produce any type of results. And once you adopt that mindset, you know, it's the elevation of consciousness. Once you have a real radical perspective on things, you do not accept the legitimacy of our given institutions. And that doesn't mean, you know, acting violent. That doesn't mean going and killing two police officers, as was the case in New York City after the Eric Garner situation. That entails, a raising of consciousness, the spreading of noncompliance and not accepting it. You know, I mentioned Cesar Chavez, and it was amazing, you know, his to nonviolence and the fact that, you know, how they got the worker reforms that they fought for a long time through boycotting. They boycotted the grape companies. They organized to boycott these powerful industries, and ultimately they brought these industries down to their knees. And they got workers reform. They got a whole bunch of different reforms that would have never existed without the boycott. And, you know, there's stuff that we can learn from that. I mean, there's certainly a lot of lessons to be learned in that type of activism. But it what really resulted in favorable change was the boycott. And we could do that. We could spread that to people out there that have no stake in the elections and say, we need to delegitimize this government, this capitalist-owned government, and we need to boycott the vote. It all starts with the boycott. And, you know, again, I think we're really, really on to something. We're ahead of curve here. I really believe this. You know, I think people have a lot of catching up to do. They have to catch up to us, but I'm confident it will happen eventually.
Yeah, definitely. What our task is, really, because we have a majority of people. I mean, in the last election, we had literally two-thirds of the voters not voting, and really, yeah, of all the people, voters and non-voters, those who are not eligible to vote, we had 75% not voting.
Right.
So we've got the people on our side. We've got to bring them to the consciousness, bring them to the realization, help them to grasp that we are a powerful political force if we get together. It's not enough just to do this individual act of staying home on election day. That's the beginning of the process. It's not the end of the process. We've got to come together as non-voters, come together as people who start to realize that what this means, this non-vote, what this means is that our government is not ruling with any legitimacy. It is not ruling with our consent.
Right.
In a sense, it's ruling against our consent, because we have not given it our consent. We've withdrawn our consent. You know, that what happened in 1775 when a large group of people across the 13 lower colonies along the Atlantic all of a sudden started realizing, hey, this parliament in London and this king in London are ruling us without our consent.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and it's just, and the election systems that we have now, we're seeing this now where such a low percentage of voters, you know, in de Blasio's case, he won with 22%.
That was 22% who came out to vote. De Blasio didn't get 22%.
Well,
de Blasio got like about half of 22% because only 22% of the people. This is extraordinary if you think about it. In New York City, the mayor's race, only 22% of the eligible voters came out to vote.
Yeah. And then you look nationwide and you see just all the millions and millions of Americans who are not eligible to vote. And you could look at the sheer numbers and realize that, hey, listen, you know, this is a system that a majority of Americans do not consent to. And you ask the working folk, you ask the working class of Americans, why is it that you don't vote? Go speak to the poor. Talk to the individuals that perhaps have a little bit better under this system. Go talk to the working poor out there. And most of these people will tell you that they don't feel that their vote means anything. They don't feel that they have a choice in this election system. And, you know, Noam Chomsky had it. I disagree with him with the number, but essentially he had it right. He said that, you know, as you get down the income ladder, votes are literally meaningless. You know, for the bottom 30% of income earners, your vote is absolutely meaningless. And this has been empirically proven. You know, Thomas mentioned the two studies, the study conducted by two professors, I believe one of them or maybe both of them were out of Princeton University. And so, this is what's happening now is that, you know, I always said that the United States of America is like a line. Those that have the most money are at the front of that line. They get served the first. And whatever scraps are left after that, you know, millions and millions of people have to fight for those scraps. And I think that's a fair comparison of our election system out there.
It's no surprise that the lower down the income rungs you get on the ladder, the less people vote and more people are non-voters. You know, and that's been a characteristic of the non-voter that's been observed by sociologists and historians who studied this for the last half century. You know, the working class and the poor make up most of the non-voters, and the middle class and the rich make up most of the voters. Figure. Well, you know, some people we hear liberals often say, "Oh, well, you know, that's the problem. The poor need to start voting. The working class need to start voting to get some power." Well, you know, we went through that with the Voting Rights Act, didn't we?
Right.
You know, that's what Selma was all about. Trying to get this Voting Rights Act. And, you know, you can understand why people who were, you know, being told that they couldn't vote, even though they knew that constitutionally they should be able to vote, they wanted to get that, the Voting Rights Act passed through Congress in 1965 because, you know, they felt like they were, they had no power and this would give them power. But let me ask you, 50 years on, where are African Americans today? Did getting the vote get them anything?
No.
You know, I mean, and it's my personal opinion that, militancy and riots and you know, people out burning down half the city is mainly what moved the civil rights movement to be able to get any of the little scraps that it was able to get back in the 60s. And it has literally, other than symbolic gestures like having a black president who is sold out to the billionaire class, African Americans are worse off today economically than they were 50 years ago. You know, we can all understand why they felt they needed the vote and why they fought for it so much, but you know what? They did not fight to get what this vote today gives them, which is jack shit.
Yeah.
They did not fight. They did not fight for a electoral system in which money determines everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's we almost have to sort of, I don't want to say, you know, again, the activism that went into that, the civil rights movement, the organizing, the militancy, it's all great, and it's all what we need to do, but the end goal of voting in today's climate, today's political climate, is not noble. Voting is not noble in our society anymore.
No.
And it's just a way to uphold the system, and you know it's killing us. We're causing our own demise. I mean,
that's I think one measure of how far we've come and how far we've advanced in progress and progressed. Because I look back at even the most militant, the Rap Brown, the H. Rap Browns, the Stokely Carmichaels, the Malcolm X's, even
right.
those people 50 years ago were fighting for the vote.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Malcolm X, you know, I mean, the movie Selma, Malcolm X was down there.
Yep.
Stokely Carmichael went down there. H. Rap Brown was there. They were fighting for the vote because they were locked into that thing that Gramsci was talking about. Even
right.
the most militant black revolutionaries in this country at that time, 50 years ago, they were captured by this illusion that voting was going to get them somewhere. And yet you look today, you know what? The statistics show that black people vote less than white people overall, percentage-wise.
Right.
Why is that? Because they know. Because they've come to break that hegemony over their brains. They've come to know that this voting is a farce. It doesn't work. You know, and if they're more likely to, you know, turn to outside the box, to outside the system, turn to noncompliance, which is what we really need.
Yeah, and that's where we come in. We come in. I think that, you know, and look, I don't have, and I know that you don't have. We're not under any type of illusions as far as you know, just. How big we are, or the influence we have. We have a very, very small. We're not even. I don't even know if we're a blip on the radar screen yet. I mean, officially, you know. I mean, the election boycott advocates. There are people out there that have heard of us, but you know, because of a lot of different things, we're not able to hold events. We're not able to go march on the Capitol or to do this and that. So you know, but where we come in is this new left, this new radical outside the box group of people that, you know, unlike the black revolutionaries who fought for the civil rights who fought for the right to vote, who believed in the election system. We don't believe in the election system. We don't believe in capitalism, perhaps in any form. We don't believe in accumulated wealth. We don't believe in millionaires and billionaires in our society. Okay, and it's these beliefs that characterize us as an organization. They characterize us, and you know what? They offer an alternative. Christopher, you tell me, where is it presented in the corporate media? Where is it presented in the cable news discussions? Where is it presented in any type of bogus election at the state level, at the federal level? A viewpoint that is challenging of capitalism, a viewpoint that challenges the balance of power, that has the same type of mark that we have. Where? I mean, voters are not presented, the consumers are not presented with any alternative because of the very issues that we're talking about. So what I'm saying here is that we're offering an alternative here. This is a real, clear, tangible alternative to what we've been seeing, in this country for such a long time now. And, you know, I, again, that's why I think that eventually people are going to say, you know what, that is an alternative. This is an alternative view of the world. It's an alternative way of thinking. It's an alternative action as opposed to voting. You don't vote. Spread noncompliance. Massive strike. Worker owned. Just fill in the blank. And that's an important point, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely is. How much time do we have?
We only have about 4 minutes or so. You know, I really kind of...
Oh, that's right. We only have 4 minutes. I had hoped that we could get to talking about the threat that Venezuela is under today.
Oh, yeah, I meant to talk
about that. In the last week, Obama has declared Venezuela a threat to the United States' security. Most Latin American countries have protested that. There was a meeting of 15 Latin American countries in Ecuador the last couple days that condemned Obama for this. And the legislature in Venezuela just voted to give President Maduro emergency powers so that Venezuela can begin to get itself ready to fight this terrible threat that our own country, the United States of America, is posing to it. So I hope people read up on that, study that. It's really important that we in America start demanding right now, Obama, hands off Venezuela. Venezuela, under its socialist government, has done extraordinary things for the working class and poor in their country, and they deserve our support.
Yeah, you've spoken out about this. You've spoken on this program about Venezuela. And how, you know, Chavez, his way, his revolutionary methods continue to have a positive effect on the people of that country, and they continually pose a problem for American imperialism, pose a problem for the American ruling class here, and that's why we've tried to undermine what has been going on in this country for a long time now. But you know what? Another thing you pointed out is that country has 200,000 worker-owned cooperatives, okay? And if only we had that existing in America, if only we had the worker-owned cooperatives that we desire, a total democracy in the workplace, much like we're seeing in Venezuela, what type of results would that bring here in the United States? So I think we need to follow the path of our brothers and sisters in this country. And I recommend what you recommend, Christopher.
And that's why Obama is so intent on destroying Venezuela, because it is this shining example of how working class people can gain power.
Yeah. Well said. Absolutely. There's no question about that. And here we are, you know, sticking our nose in other people's businesses like we've been doing for a long time now. It's you know, if our leadership is doing one thing, we need to do the opposite. If they're saying one thing, we need to say the opposite. And I really regret not scheduling this for 2 hours. But I got to tell you, we went by. This is a great show. We really, really had a very, very engaging show here. So I want to encourage everybody to visit our website, electionboycott.weebly.com. Also, facebook.com/electionboycottadvocates. Christopher, it's been a pleasure, and I'll speak to you next week.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Take care, my friend.
Bye-bye.